Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pulse.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Inkblack Heart, this time covering chapters 83 through 87 of Part 4 and Part 5. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Inkblack Heart will occasionally reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series.
We're still kind of living in no news land over here. Jo's been pretty quiet on Twitter this month. I hope that either means that she's deep in book 8 or she's on vacation.
Okay, well, both would be nice.
Her birthday's soon, so a vacation would be nice.
Oh, yeah.
It's summer. Sounds a bit creepy that I know when her birthday is and I'm throwing it out there casually.
How? That's normal.
Everyone knows what her birthday from Harry Potter, right?
Yeah. That's common not a weird knowledge.
Thing. Yeah. Okay.
Nope, that's completely normal. You're not a stalker.
Not a weirdo.
That's me. Completely normal.
Motto of the podcast.
That's the motto of our podcast. We're completely normal.
Yep.
Practically normal in almost every way.
Yeah, I hope she's taking a vacation. She has earned it. Plus, she's got to gear up for the release of Running Grave. So I'm sure she's got to take some time off.
That's going to be so soon.
God, before you know it, we're going to start getting little teasers.
Yeah, we need the cover and the blurb.
I feel like at any point it's possible that we're going to get it. And so at any point, one of these episodes can be in the past where we've already, future us could have this as this is coming out.
You're so right. Oh my God.
It could happen any minute.
We got to stay strong. We got to be cool, be chill.
Cool. Be cool. We're cool.
Be normal.
That's the hardest part when we get to like the last 2 months before it comes out is just the worst.
The closer we get, the slower time moves.
Yeah.
We should make a guide to getting through the last 2 months where it's like, try to find a different hobby. You know?
Watch other fictional detectives.
Here are some recommendations that almost scratch the itch.
And then at the end be like, we're totally kidding. Nothing helps.
Nothing.
There's an email we got the other day that I'd like to read. We got this email from Lakshmi about the color blue. I thought you guys would like this. So she said, I'm a longtime listener of your podcast and it's one of my favorite things ever. Thank you. I thought I'd share something interesting I read about the color blue discussion. Pools mentioned that Robin's favorite color might be blue. She has blue curtains. The plant pot is blue, etc. And she might be onto something. The Raoul Duffy print is relevant with regard to the color blue too, as Duffy considered blue to be unique and stated the following. Blue is the only color that holds on to its individuality in all its shades. Take the various tones of blue, from the darkest to the lightest, and they will still be blue, whereas yellow goes black in the shadows and it vanishes at its lightest. Dark red turns into brown, and red diluted with white isn't red, but pink, a different color. I think it could certainly signify themes of Robin's unique set of attributes and her growing sense of individuality and independence we see in this story. We also see her in blue items of clothing and the blue really complimenting her, the blue dress, the blue shirt she wears in the seaside town. I found it interesting, so I thought I'd share. I thought this was great. I'm 100% willing to get on the blue is Robin's favorite color hill with everyone.
I am so on board with this. I love the symbolism of blue holding on to its individuality.
Me too.
You know, Robin might have gone through a time of suppressing herself, of doing and being what other people wanted. But the real Robin was always there. And now she's come into herself and she's thriving, right? She's held on to that sense of self. And I love it. Both Robin and Cormoran, who is also connected with blue, obviously, have that strong sense of, you know, a vocation, what they're meant to do, no matter what. This is them. It can't be watered down or changed. It just makes so much sense. And yeah, she does look good in blue.
And we know he likes her in blue.
We do. If only he'd said it.
I know.
Still salty, like the ocean, which is blue. I connected the dots.
Oh, man.
I did it.
That was a brilliant leap.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that email, though. I really liked it. And I'm here for it.
Totally. I love that. Plus, also, you know, y'all missed the most important part of that. And that is that her favorite person in the whole world is Cormoran Blue Strike.
Right.
Very important. I love all of this.
Her favorite person, her favorite color.
All right, should we do our Q&A?
Yes.
Are you learning more about London from writing and researching these novels?
One of the great pleasures of this series for me is London, writing about the London that I know. So although I'm not a Londoner, I have lived here. I lived here when I was young and I've always had family in London. So when I was a child, I would visit London regularly to visit family. I tend to, I don't use locations often that I know particularly well, because otherwise it wouldn't be exciting. It wouldn't be a truthful portrait of London, because London's changed a lot as well since I was living here in my 20s. So yeah, part of the pleasure is exploring London, plotting and thinking, well, that would be good if that happened there, and then I'm going to have to go and visit there to really understand what's there, because it'll be changed since I was in my 20s. So yeah, that's a huge part of the pleasure of these books, and they have led me to parts of London that I would not have visited, you know, in my normal visiting my publisher, or, you know, coming down to visit a friend in London. There's so much I want to say, but I shall merely say that in this book particularly, there are parts of London and of the southeast that I'm not familiar with, and I became familiar with, and it was so pleasurable.
Okay, my first question is, do we know what place she means by the southeast? Because I have no understanding of what's where.
Oh, I think that what she's talking about is the southeast region of England. So London is right next to the southeast. So it's an actual region, and it includes Oxford and Oxfordshire in it. Reading, the Cotswolds are in the southeast. A lot of their little road trips have taken them through or into the region. So it's interesting. We know she got to explore some places there she wasn't previously familiar with, which is nice.
I'm glad that this is something she loves so much about these books, because I think it's been truly one of the greatest pleasures that fans have taken from them as well, going and visiting all of these places. And while the only time I've been to London was before Strike, it's something I really want to be able to do at some point in the future. And I know it'll be special and dorky.
Yeah, I completely agree on wanting to visit London again, you know, now that we've read these books, and getting to visit the locations in the future and how special that would be. It's already such a neat feeling seeing pictures of the places mentioned in these books when other fans visit, that actually being there, that's got to be something else.
Yeah. It is. I can attest.
Oh, yeah. Because whenever you went on your honeymoon, right?
Yeah, to London specifically so that I could see Strike. No, because it looked really nice. Uh-huh. But I did do a little Strike pilgrimage on one day.
Of course.
With my husband, dragged him along.
That's one of the good things that my husband reads the book. So he, you know, nice. If we go, he's going to be there. He also listens to this podcast, which I don't know if that's a smart idea for him.
You'd think he'd turn down a bit of the thirst if your husband was, but no.
Well, he's a fictional man.
Wait. You think that I would turn it down?
Yeah.
I do.
Oh. Uh-oh. Well, that's a new and terrifying piece of information.
This is her toned down.
Uh-oh. Yikes. Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. Oh, boy. All right. Sorry, David. Okay. I really like Joe describing the way she goes, and she says, plotting and thinking. It's so exciting, especially when I remember that someone saw her doing maybe those things at the church at the end of Denmark Street, you know?
Yes.
Oh, man. It's going to end up being nothing romantic at all. Watch.
Yep, absolutely. The opposite.
Pulls his face at me right now. I was like, take it back.
At some point, she has to give us something romantic, for the love of God.
Let it be straightforward and romantic. Fuck.
There'll be other things romantic, but, you know, the things we think it might not be. I would also really love to know what else she wanted to say, because she says, there's so much I want to say, and I just love to know what that is.
Like, please share.
I know. Joe, if you ever want to fully talk about location visiting in London or whatever, you are more than welcome.
Anytime.
100%.
I know a few people who would love to talk to you about any of those things.
Right? Mm-hmm. I want to hear all of it. What I found interesting here was that she talks about her memories of London from when she was in her 20s and how much it's changed. And I've just realized she's probably drawing on these memories to inform Strike's childhood and teenage memories, right? Because the timelines would sort of roughly match up.
Yes, you're right.
So I feel like that's probably a bit of authenticity in the way she remembers it and the way Strike remembers it.
All right, should we start chapter 83?
All right. In this chapter, Strike and Robin debrief after the interview with Rachel Ludwell, and Midge calls with evidence against Jago Ross.
So the epigraph to chapter 83. They are all of them so faithless. Their torment is your gain. Would you keep your own heart scatheless? Be the one to give the pain. And that is from Cottage Courtship by Letitia Elizabeth Landon.
What does cottage courtship mean?
It would be like rural pastoral courtship, I think. Like the courtship of the regular people living out in the cottages.
So you can maybe put that onto...
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you put it into modern times, it would be like internet courtship.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay, I could see that. Yeah, but that works because to me, the epigraph is really speaking to the whole kosh pickup artist incel mindset, viewing women as faithless, thinking that the best way to, I don't want to say make a connection with a woman, because that's not what they're trying to do. They're trying to just acquire women like objects, collect as many as possible. But this whole nasty, negging, prescripted, heartless approach to human relations is seen by them as a way to win, to be the one with the upper hand, to be the one giving the pain. The poem as a whole works for this because it's about sort of the strategy of keeping a lover by not being too nice. You know, you gotta keep them on their toes, keep them insecure, keep them hoping for a smile by not giving out too many, right? That's how you keep them invested.
How is the world still the same?
People have not changed much.
Yeah, I also thought that this was about the Kosh book. And now that you've given more context for the whole poem, yeah, I think that that's what this is.
All right, we start out this chapter with Strike doing some research into Morehouse, since Rachel Ledwell just told us what his real name is at the end of the previous chapter.
I just think it's so cute that it says he does this after he'd heartily congratulated her.
That is
I love that.
No.
And probably told her she was a genius again.
A million times. She probably blushed all happy. Yeah. Aww.
I know I mentioned it last time, I'm pretty sure, but I love how generous he is with his praise of her and that he's not at all threatened by her success at all. He genuinely is super happy for her being successful in what she loves doing. I love that.
It's really great.
It's too early to start.
No, it's never too early to start swooning.
This kind of makes me wonder why they didn't make finding Morehouse more of a priority earlier. Mm. Because it seems like it would have been a smart strategy. Since Enemy is so well hidden, why not track down his partner, who may not have been quite as careful, and then put pressure on him to expose Enemy, right? He's the weak link. I mean, there's probably a reason they didn't do this that I'm not thinking of, but it seems like it would have been better than just following people to see if they're on their phones when Enemy's tweeting, which is exhausting.
It could have been a way to go. I guess it could have also led to a lot of frustration if they were never able to find him and now they've put all this energy into a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
It could have worked out, but I don't know if they were aware of the cracks in that friendship until much later.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure when they were, or even that they were two different people.
True.
So maybe they just didn't have enough information to think that that was worth pursuing.
Yeah, possibly.
I don't know.
It's too bad they didn't, though, because if they'd found him earlier.
Just another what if.
Mm.
Robin then tells Strike Rachel's story about Zoltan.
Yeah, there's a lot of dialogue here, but basically she's starting to put it all together that all these accounts are likely one person and using the same pickup lines all over the internet.
So unoriginal.
Can I say that I love the line where Strike is preparing to be amused by these shitty pickup lines? Because he knows that he's about to hear some nonsense. Yeah, I too am preparing to be amused by this.
Now, the discussion of the pickup lines that Zoltan/Gus was trying to use on Rachel sparks a brainwave in Strike, and we get to see that excellent memory of his at work again. Because he's reminded here of the conversation between Henry and his friend about the American pickup artist in Chapter 51. At Madeline's jewelry launch.
It's a lucky thing that he's so observant and has such a good memory.
I think if Strike hadn't thought of this, one of them might have Googled one of the lines and it could have led them there.
Yeah.
But that this is a way for it to be planted for us, and it's more fun to read.
Very true.
Strike then begins to read from this ebook of Kosh's, and obviously it's awful, but there's something really hilarious in the audiobook about listening to Robert Glenister read the phrase lower grade pussy in his Strike voice, because it's nothing like so Strike at all.
It was actually quite strange for me to listen to that. Bit cringy to hear the Strike voice saying that word, because even though he's just reading it, it's so not him, and it was just like, ooh.
But his attitude towards all of this bullshit is, as usual, great. And again, I know the bar is on the floor, but any example of a dude not being shitty in this book is one I'll take when there are so many men behaving badly.
He does look even better than he already is by comparison with all the other male specimens in these novels, though. But I absolutely love the banter between him and Robin as he's reading this, because they are so funny. And the scorn that they heap on this piece of trash is really well deserved.
I have a question that might amuse some people. When Strike first starts reading, he pauses to explain that Kosh is American, and Robin says, "And I'm warming to him already." What was it that caused Strike to need to explain that Kosh was American? Because I can't recognize what's American in those first few sentences, since I am one. I don't know what it is.
I couldn't figure that either.
Okay, good.
Is it maybe the phrase to get hit on? Is there another way they phrase it in the UK?
Chatting up? I don't know.
Chatting up to pull? I know that they use pulling a lot. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that one.
Or is it rating women by numbers? Because I'd have thought that was a universal shitty thing.
I don't know.
Also, Robin seems to be out here being biased against Americans. Which is so rude.
I always assumed that she said she was warming to him already because of how gross those opening sentences were.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We might have to phone a UK friend for this one and ask. I don't know what it is. Someone help me out. Let me know what that is.
Yeah. Good listening question there.
I remember feeling a slight sense of, I can't believe he's reading this out loud to Robin. Just because it felt awkward to me. But I know that could just be because I'm awkward. I don't know. Did anyone else feel that?
I didn't really, because I could imagine the tone that he's reading this in. Like, he's not just sitting there reading this neutrally. I'm betting that the way he's reading it is ranging from like sarcastic to scornful to laughing. Like, he's reading it as a commentary as well as like the comments they're making. Although now that I say that, that interpretation might just be in my own head. But I mean, I've read similarly stupid stuff out loud to my husband and friends to make fun of it, including some terrible explicit smut sometimes.
Oh my God, that's so awkward to me. Oh, I can't do
funny.
It.
It's funny. No. But maybe I just have a higher awkwardness tolerance for that.
You do, or I have a very low tolerance because that sounds terrible.
Maybe it's in the middle.
Yeah. I like that he does read it because it's a good part between the two of them. And I like Robin seeing that he is also put off by this behavior.
I mean, as part of their job, they probably have to talk.
Yeah, they're probably used to this.
Because all of these weird fetishes that people are doing, following these adulterers, they probably have gotten pictures of people up against a wall or something. Like, it might be a bit desensitized.
Yeah, you're probably right.
In light of this revelation about the popularity of kosh lines among the boys and men of the Ink Black Heart cartoon fandom, Robin and Strike circle back around to their updated anime theories.
I find it interesting that Robin agrees with Rachel when it comes to the Edie and I are basically the same person line, sounding more like a girl, because in our last episode, we didn't really think so. Maybe it's hard for us to answer that clearly now since we already know.
Yeah. That might be it.
What Robin is actually suggesting is that Kia is anime and that she was actually hit on by one of these other guys online and not anime.
Robin does make a fair point here about asking why Kia wouldn't save that conversation. It seems so strange to me that she didn't take screenshots when it happened. I wonder if she did, but she just didn't want to show them to Strike for some reason. Maybe there was something about the way she responded that she didn't want him to see.
No, I think if that were the case, we would have found out about it at some point if she had been hiding something. I have to imagine that someone as pretty as Kia might get hit on all the time, so maybe this wasn't a rare occurrence for her to have something awful like this said to her.
Oh yeah, maybe.
Or maybe we're just so used to people taking screenshots of drama that when someone doesn't do it, we're like, that's weird.
I think that's where I am. I'm like, why wouldn't you screenshot that? Yeah.
I wonder if Kia has weird feelings towards Ink Black Heart fans because she believes that they should be her fans.
That makes sense. She's not really like in the fandom with anime. Yeah, she's outside of being like, how dare you?
You should like me.
Yeah, so that might be why she doesn't have the same like perspective towards anime as everyone else in the fandom does somehow.
Yeah, I think so.
That makes sense.
But here's where Strike comes in and nails it again, because he says there's no reason anime couldn't be masquerading as one of these Maxes and Zoltans who are out there trying to pick up girls, is there?
Literally nail on the head.
As one of these. He is so close.
I know.
He is so close. Just think a little bit bigger, Strike.
Strike can't understand why you would want to be on Twitter as one person.
Yeah, right. I think Strike and Robin just aren't terminally online enough to be suspicious of multiple accounts. They don't have that sock puppet that? Experience. Yeah. Who would do that indeed? Streaming my tea at someone.
Yeah. What's also so funny is that Robin responds that it's possible, but my God, if anime's running the game, tweeting all the time and trying to pick up as many girls as possible using Kasha's system, when would they ever sleep?
It doesn't seem like running the game actually takes that much work on anime's part, because he's got Morehouse to do all the tech stuff. He has a team of moderators that he's somehow persuaded to work scheduled shifts, which is insane. Seems like all he does is just swan into the game sometimes to chat to specific people or enjoy the attention. He actually has a lot of time for Twitter.
So let's jump to Midge's phone call to Strike and what happened with Jago Ross. Yeah. This is juicy.
Ooh, yeah.
This is super juicy. She's about to spill the tea.
Yeah, she is. Mm-hmm. We all know what happened. Midge was trespassing and watching them when she witnessed Jago abusing his daughters, eventually leading to one of them getting their leg broken. So I have to say, I have not been a huge Midge fan for this book for reasons I've already said, but obviously this endears me to her.
Mm-hmm.
I love that Instinct took over and she just ran out to help that girl. I like the way she wasn't afraid to stand up to Jago, and I even like the way she talks to Strike.
Me too. I mean, I obviously love this whole bit as well. And it's exactly what Robin would have done too. This bit, what was she supposed to do? Said Robin heatedly, who was entirely on Midge's side. It's absolutely fantastic because, yeah, of course she's on Midge's side. You go, girls.
The fact that she says it heatedly tells me that her anger is flaring up again really quickly about this situation.
Yeah.
But I don't actually think that Strike is being insensitive to the girl getting hurt or saying that Midge shouldn't have done what she did, because I actually think that Strike would have done the same thing.
Yeah, 100% would
if
have.
He could have outrun him.
To be fair, he could absolutely take Jago in a fist fight, so he doesn't need to outrun him. He can just put him in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Let's go for that one.
Yeah, that would be satisfying as well.
Strike beating the shit out of horrible men.
Strike would have a harder time hiding behind a bush, though.
A little bit.
Maybe it was a really big bush. I don't know.
You could pretend to be a tree.
I think he's just also thinking of the practical side, the potential liability and problems that could cause for them all if Jago knew who Midge worked for.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's his name on the line. But I do like Midge's tone of, you're not going to like this, but suck it up.
Yeah, his attitude definitely stems from the practical worries here. And honestly, Midge did pretty well considering the situation, and her attitude heading off any complaining, like you just said, Linz, is just great.
Yeah, it doesn't feel insubordinate to me at all or inappropriate, because in this job, they have to think on their feet, and she's the one putting herself in danger. So she has to just go with her instincts.
Yeah, you make me think that. So there's a comparison to be made between the good subcontractors like Barclay and Dev and Midge and the ones like Netley. And you want the first client for your agency because they have initiative. They think for themselves. They're smart. They take risks to get the job done. But it's precisely because of those traits that situations like this happen. So Midge isn't going to passively sit by and watch this girl get crushed for precisely the reasons that she's there to witness it at all. Her initiative, her brains, caring about the job and about justice. It's the stuff that makes a good investigator, you know, but maybe a double-edged sword, if I'm making sense.
No, it does make sense. I just think that there is another side to the argument. You have to have some sort of balance when it comes to the concerns that Strike must be having, because if you have subcontractors who never think about those things, it can become a liability.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't fault Midge for doing this. I'm glad she did. But I also think it's part of Strike's job to question these things and make sure people who work for him know that he follows rules and has boundaries for what is and isn't okay.
That makes a ton of sense. And I mean, that's why he's Mr. Manager. He's the boss man.
That's why he makes the big money.
Because he has to pay attention to stupid shit like rules.
Rules, yeah. I think Robin must feel the way she does because she too reacts instinctually, as we know. Where Strike is, as J.K. Rowling said, more measured about these things. But you have to have that balance.
Yeah, that's true. There are so many good lines in this phone call, though. I love how Midge focuses on getting the random little details right, because first of all, we get to see Robin's horse knowledge again with the whole outdoor school thing, which I love. And also, Strike getting frustrated is hilarious to me when he says, forget the fucking horticulture, what happened?
It's been a while since I talked about how I see myself in Strike, but this
has been like
so
5 minutes.
This is so me. When someone's telling me a story and focuses too much on little details, I die inside. Just tell me what happened, because then I lose.
Yes.
I can't focus on the story. I lose what they're talking about.
I do the same thing. I get so bored if people are throwing in little irrelevant details. Like, sum it up.
Exactly.
Anyway, back to the phone call.
Uh-huh.
For some reason, I'm interested in this line. And then he came after me with the horsewhip. Thought that was the kind of thing that went out with the Victorians.
Mm.
And I suppose it's interesting to me because we've talked about the Victorian period before as an influence on this novel, both in the epigraphs and in the concept of enemy. And what Midge says here expresses the idea that we've progressed as a society, that we've moved past all the, you know, the terrible aspects of that period, the privileged aristocrats, the violence. But I guess it just highlights the fact that in many ways, nothing has really changed. There are still classes of people who believe that they can get away with anything because of their money and their blood, and basically they can. The brutality is the same. It's worse. We're facing all the same problems as a society, just in a brand new and exciting form. And I don't know, it's interesting.
I think that's a really great catch, and I really like it. Everything about Jago Ross and his whole family does feel very old-fashioned.
Yeah, it feels like a Dickens villain a little bit.
But still so real.
Yeah, very real. Dudes, yep. Be like this.
They do. I know him. I think, Kenzie, you had said this before, that some people think that Jago is like a one-dimensional villain.
Yeah, like a cartoon villain. Yeah.
If that's how you feel, consider yourself very lucky.
Yes.
I am really happy, though, that Strike noticed Robin's angry expression and that they finally got a bit of this out in the open. Strike says, "I'm not happy the kid got hurt." "I never thought you were," said Robin coolly. "So why the Medusa stare?" I like that, by the way. That's funny.
Me too. That's so good.
"Just thinking, those girls aren't going to be helped by knowing their father's been filmed hurting them. All that's likely to happen is that he'll be a bit more careful about who's watching." Strike took his e-cigarette out of his pocket as he turned his gaze back to the M11 and said, "I haven't forgotten trying to get them some help. If I can do both, I will." And I just wonder what Robin thought in response to this, because it was just an hour or two earlier that she was thinking he was just going to take the information and blackmail Jago with it.
This is another one of those moments where I really want to be in Robin's head to read what she's thinking about all of this.
All the moments.
Yes.
I think that Robin's probably still quite worried about that if he can do both, he'll help the kids. She probably interprets that as the girl's safety not being his highest priority. But in fairness to him, the agency and his livelihood is probably rightfully of the most concern to him, right? But we know that he cares and that he is going to come up with a plan that does both.
I guess I just feel like, cut him a little slack, Robin. Like, he really is doing the best that he can. Luckily, we don't have to live in this much longer.
Yes.
Almost over.
Oh, I can't wait.
All right. Should we jump into 84?
Yes.
In this chapter, Strike and Robin find Morehouse, aka VCAS, dead. The epigraph, "What was my sin to merit this?" And that is from Zara by Christina Rossetti.
I feel like this is the last message we get to hear from Morehouse. You know, he's saying, "What did I do to deserve this?"
I agree. That's 100% what this is. Trying to find this poem drove me crazy. There were two different versions under the same title on the internet.
Uh-huh.
But I looked into it, and it turns out that Rossetti actually wrote three poems called Zara.
Okay.
The paper I read about this identified each of them by their first lines. They were part of a collection of eight poems that explored characters and situations from the work of a Gothic novelist, Maturin. The Zara poems are based on his novel Women. This particular epigraph is from the Zara, which begins, "The pale sad face of her I wronged." And the poem itself is sort of a journey through the speaker's feelings about love betrayed. It travels through guilt because her love for a man inadvertently wronged another woman, to anger and a desire for revenge at this guy who betrayed her, to the sad fact that she still loves him, and then the vain hope that one day he might come back to her. And I think that the parallels with Morehouse and Gus/Paperwhite are definitely there in those sort of emotions that Vikas was feeling this whole time. But basically, this one line perfectly sums this up.
I'm glad you solved that mystery, though.
I did solve the mystery because it was driving me crazy.
Yeah, when you mentioned it last night, I was like, wait a second. Did we miss another misattribution? But
I guess you clicked on the right one first off, and I clicked on the wrong one.
I remember looking for this when I was checking all of them, but I didn't notice that there were different ones.
I'm just like, why would you not call it Zara A? Zara B.
Yeah.
Zara 1, 2, 3. Come on. Anyway, I solved the mystery.
Great detective work. I know this is horrible that we're about to find Morehouse murdered, but I have to say, I love this chapter.
Oh my God. Say it. It's so good.
So good.
We get the answers to so many questions that we have been asking for 6 books.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 2 questions.
Yeah.
That's still a lot of questions.
It is. It feels like more because of how badly we wanted the answers to these.
Yes.
The only other big one is how he got his medal, right?
Yeah.
I feel like that's a big one.
Maybe she's saving that for book 7.
It would be amazing if we got to learn that in book 7.
So good. Oh my God.
That would be so good.
I feel like that's going to get me in my heart a bit.
Yes. Guaranteed.
There's a line here that makes me laugh when they're walking through Cambridge. Strike says, Caius, one of the blokes the place was named after, obviously, was renowned for his unusual entry rules, barring the sick and infirm as well as the Welsh from studying here. Well, obviously all sensible people will be with him on the Welsh, but I doubt Caius would have wanted to miss out on Vika's bardwaj. It reminded me of Irene from Troubled Blood, remember, when she's like, I remember once I said, Eddie, you think if I so much as look at a man, he can be queer, he can be Welsh.
That's my favorite Irene moment. It's so funny. Right? There's not a lot of good Irene moments to pick from, but that one really made me laugh.
Definitely a good one.
Obviously, I think Strike is just joking, but I think I'm remembering correctly that there were people actually insulted by this part of the book, or maybe it was just haters finding a reason to be insulted.
Yeah.
I think I remember there were some fans who took issue with the comment. I do wonder whether or not this is one of those instances where Jo is either writing views that don't necessarily align with her own because she said that Strike might have some politics she doesn't necessarily agree with, or if maybe Strike's just being a bit tongue-in-cheek here.
Yeah, no, I think this is just a joke.
Just Strike is not genuinely anti-Welsh.
Anti-Welsh sentiment is unfortunately a thing that does exist, but I don't think that that's what's happening here.
No, yeah. He's joking.
Yeah, of course.
Tongue is firmly in cheek there.
I found this really interesting. So I looked up the actual text of the rule this guy instituted, if anyone is interested. Mm-hmm. Caius accepted no payment for his services as master, but insisted on several rules, including that the college must admit no scholar who is deformed, dumb, blind, lame, maimed, mutilated, a Welshman, or suffering from any grave or contagious illness, or an invalid that is sick in a serious measure. And I was like, that is a long list. I wanted to look into this more, so I got my hands on a book about this college's history, and the author provides two possible explanations for this Welsh thing.
Okay, interesting.
And the first is that this was a scribal error, and the word should have been Gallicum instead of Wallicum, which meant Welsh, and Gallicum would have been referring to a venereal disease.
That's just a one-letter difference?
Yeah, one-letter difference.
That seems possible going along with the other things that he wrote.
But there was also his theory that there was a Welsh doctor who was a fellow at the college but left abruptly and mysteriously a few months after this guy Caius became the master. And the theory is that this guy had pissed him off enough that he added Welshman to this list because he's like, that fucking guy, no more Welsh people up in here.
That's really interesting. I kind of like option two, just for the drama of it all.
I know, me too.
But I think probably number one is more likely.
Yeah, but I want to hear more about that Welsh doctor.
I do too. I'd like to hear the story.
But anyway, moving on from the Welsh.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm glad you looked that up.
It was a fun rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But I like the moment where Strike observes that the college doesn't look very wheelchair friendly, because I think that his perspective on this is really shaped by his own challenges with accessibility, right? Would he have noticed something like this before he lost his leg and had to learn how to navigate spaces that aren't designed with this in mind?
Maybe. He knows that they're looking for someone who uses a wheelchair, but losing his leg had to have opened his eyes to these kinds of things. How could it not?
Yeah.
So definitely.
Yeah, this bit where Strike gets all snippy when Robin comments that Cambridge would be a great place to study is really great.
We talked about how we like Robin being judgy over art. I kind of like this too.
Yeah, me too. I do like that we see how being at a university is bringing up these traumatic memories for her, but we see her refocus deliberately on something else, judging the architecture, a coping mechanism that she's mentioned before, where you acknowledge the thoughts and then you change the station.
And what I love so much is that it doesn't cause her to go down a bad path of continued bad thoughts or anxiety. She really does acknowledge it, and then she pulls herself back. And in just a minute after thinking these horrible things, she's going to be laughing uncontrollably.
Yeah.
And then we learn not one, but two things that we've wanted to learn about Strike for ages, and that's what Strike studied at Oxford and how he knows Latin.
And it's the most Strike thing that's ever struck. I don't know. Yeah.
Whatever it is, it was 100% worth the wait to find out.
Oh, yeah, it was so good. So Strike studied history. Was that on anyone's list of guesses?
I think that might have been further down on the list for me. I think my first guess was PPE, which I believe that is philosophy, politics, and economics, if I'm remembering correctly. But I really loved this. It's not what I would have initially expected, but it feels very him to me.
I think that PPE was my first guess too, but I know I had history on my list. I thought he might be interested in military history, and it seemed like a relevant subject if he was planning on joining the army after graduating. But yeah, history does seem very him. He's a traditional guy.
I'd like to see him nerd out about something.
Yeah, that would be really cute.
It puts into perspective the whole thing with Jack, too.
Oh my God, it does. He's so proud of Jack's history paper. Oh my God. Okay, I need to...
Do you need a moment?
I need the closet.
Yeah, this might sound really cheesy, but I loved learning this about him. That one little word on the page made me feel like I got to know him a little better.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, completely. Yeah, I agree with that. I promise you that we know that he's not a real person.
I know. It's okay. This is a safe space. You know, it's fine.
Definitely.
But back to the story of why and how Strike knows Latin. This is another one of my favorite parts of the book. I love that it has nothing to do with Charlotte. I love that he was just a 13-year-old kid. And I love that it makes Robin laugh so uncontrollably that it makes Strike laugh too. It's just such a good part. And I needed this little boost of happiness after that cool moment in the car in the last chapter.
Yeah, it is so good. And I think I can kind of see now why Strike didn't want to go into exactly why or how he understood Latin and Lethal White when Robin was asking about it. Because, like, no, it's not a particularly long story, but they weren't as close as they are now. So I feel like, you know, somebody telling you at 13, like, hey, you're not going to amount to anything. Yeah, that's kind of personal. Heavy. Yeah, exactly. And really personal. So it makes more sense that he's telling her this now.
And I can understand why 13-year-old Cormoran would absolutely hate being told by some pompous man that he would never amount to anything. Mm-hmm. I don't think it takes a psychologist to understand that the reason likely came from wanting to prove his own father wrong.
Yeah, and also, look here, fools, more kleptomania with Strike nicking Mr. Pretentious Asshole's Latin books after leaving the squad.
It's the origin story.
And thus began the crime spree of the century. Amazing.
When Strike says that he used Latin many times to good effect, I wasn't the only one who thought of that moment in Silkworm when he uses Latin to one-up Fancourt, right?
Oh, you know? Definitely. Definitely. It just makes me think of that line in that chapter about Fancourt being surprised that a man that looked like Strike read books and paid attention to them.
Robin makes a joke next. She says, "This is a whole new side of you," said Robin, trying with difficulty to suppress her laughter. "I should have told you no gentleman can hold his head up until he thoroughly understands sheep reproduction. He'd probably have run off to get a degree in it." And then Strike responds, "No offense to your father," said Strike, grinning, "but if you need a degree to understand how sheep reproduce, you've got bigger worries than whether you're a gentleman." Oh, I just love that they're dipping their toes back into the Ritz talk again. It's so good.
They are. The taboo on the whole anything approaching it is starting to wear off. They're starting to kind of creep up to the outskirts of what they really want / need to talk about. It all feels like the tiny first steps to one of them broaching the subject of the almost kiss. And I love that it's Robin who instigates it both times, here and earlier when she mentioned Ritz level service.
It's interesting because last time we talked about how Strike is the one to ask about Hugh Jacks, and he's the one who thinks that they need to talk about it at the end. They're both sort of making their way.
Yeah, it's coming from both sides. It's equal. It's not one. They both want the same thing.
My heart. Okay.
Yeah.
It seems like when they're just laughing together is when it's most likely to come up.
Laughing together or drunk?
I prefer laughing. I feel like they're not going to be drunk when they talk about it officially.
Hopefully. Yeah. I would like that for them to just be sober and laughing and suddenly, oh shit, we're talking about this, right?
Oh my God. Can you just imagine the way that it's going to describe, like, the nervousness, the heart racing? Okay. Sorry.
It'll kill me. I'll be dead. But
were you guys surprised that he told Robin how he used Latin the night he met Charlotte?
I was, because we rarely see him be open with Robin about the whole Charlotte mess. I did not expect this at all.
Yeah.
It's totally. Such a good sign, though, that he's doing this.
Yeah, I think so.
Robin stops laughing to listen because, you know, she wants the details about Charlotte.
Yeah, she does.
I don't know how I ever thought that Charlotte didn't have as much of a hold over her in this book as she did in Trouble Blood. If anything, I think it's more now. Forget everything I ever said in that past episode. I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking because it's so obvious.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think that the same honestly holds true for Charlotte about Robin in a later book.
I think that Robin's going to have a lot of questions for him when it feels right to ask and be pleasantly surprised by his answers. You know what I mean? Like, have you slept with her since I've known you? And when he says no, she's going to be like,
Because I'm sure it won't just be like a no, it'll be like a fuck no, like, yeah, you know, an emphatic no.
Yeah, because she's so worried about that.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you both that Charlotte still has this hold over her. But this conversation is clearly showing that she no longer has this hold over Strike. Aww. You know, it shows that really well because he can talk about her as part of his past without all these strong emotions coming up. She doesn't have that grip on his heart anymore. We know who does.
Who?
Shanker.
There's a love story we never expected out of these
a love
books.
Story for the
talk
ages.
About twist endings, right?
Can we talk about his moves with Charlotte though?
Yes,
because we know that his first line was to ask about the stain on his shirt, so he starts off by making her laugh, but then finds out her interest and just recites a love poem to her
in Latin.
In Latin. It's not bad, is it?
No, it's a genius move. It subverts expectations. It intrigues interest by playing with contrasts. No wonder Strike manages to get so many gorgeous girlfriends. He's got game. He should, you know what he should do is he should write a book.
It would be better than Cautious.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It sure would be. Talk to women like they're human beings.
Oh, yeah.
And then they might want to sleep with you. That's the whole book.
Genius.
I really wish that we had heard Robin's thoughts about this or that she had gotten to respond in some sort of way.
Yeah.
I figure Joe does this on purpose, so we're not getting everything all at once, but it is it's a bit of a killer.
Especially after that bit with Strike describing he and Charlotte's relationship as 16 years of fucking pain and the poem being appropriate because of how things were between Lesbia and Catullus. I want to know how she feels about it.
I wonder if Robin ever thinks about the 16 years, because if he had gotten back with Charlotte at some point in the last 5 years, which I think we agree that Robin's worried about, that timeline would be longer than 16 years, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
At this point, it's been 21 years since he's met Charlotte.
Oh my God, it has been.
Even if they're still doing the whole on and off thing, it would be longer than 16.
Yeah.
It might be 17 or 18, maybe.
The funny thing about all of this is that this walk that they took was kind of pointless because they're in the wrong place. They have to turn around and go back. But it was the opposite of pointless to me because it gave us this great moment between them, and it's one of my favorite parts.
Yes, I want to say something profound about the journey being more important than the destination, or getting lost being the key to discovery. Just pretend I said something really profound and smart.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, we all know. Yeah.
We'll fix it in post.
That was genius, Pools. So insightful and deep. I feel moved.
Deep like the ocean.
But when they do get to where Vikas lives, obviously I'm glad that Strike and Robin were able to get inside easily, but it does drive me crazy how easily people just let others in.
Yeah, fucking lax, as Strike would say.
As they approach, there's a man and a woman there, and Robin knows something is wrong. The fear in their faces, the smell in the air. I know it's an awful part, but I do love seeing Strike in this mode where he's taking charge and he knows exactly what to do. You can tell it's comforting to these other people.
Yeah, they're scared. They need someone to
take charge.
I also love that we're seeing how Robin's instincts have been honed by doing the job. She feels that it's wrong, but she can also identify intellectually every single aspect of the situation that's making it feel that way.
Yeah.
She knows what all of this is pointing to, even though she doesn't really want to know.
She totally does. And I love how it's described, you know, with her heart had begun to race and it knew what her mind didn't want to accept. That was really good.
When they open the door, his body and wheelchair are facing the door. Do you think that that's just how he was because he turned talking to Gus? Or do you think that Gus staged it like this because he wanted him to face the door so that it was an immediate shock to whoever found him?
I'm thinking that maybe he staged it that way. I'm just imagining how arrogant and how cruel Gus is, just kind of coming up behind him during this whole evil villain monologue that I'm sure that, you know, he would be going through, telling him that he was Paperwhite the whole time, and then just coming up behind him and slitting his throat and then printing out that message about Vikas being in Birmingham.
I'm curious how all of this went down. Maybe once the door was open, he just pushed his way in and then took the mask off, revealed everything, killed him, put the mask back on before leaving.
I personally think it's likely that Gus used the element of surprise to overpower Vikas. Like you said, push his way in. Mm-hmm. Immediately slit his throat. I think if he'd spent any time villain monologuing, as you said, Kenz, he could have risked Vikas figuring out some way to fight him off or alert someone. I think he'd have wanted to be as quick about this murder as possible.
I feel like he might have been able to take more time with this than, like, Edie. I mean, that's out in public in the middle of the day. I get what you're saying. I just have a hard time believing that someone as arrogant as Gus would have been able to not tell him.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't think it needed to be long. But he could have literally just said, I'm Paperwhite, I killed Edie, and I can't let you betray me, the end. And that would only take seconds, and he'd get his stupid moment.
Maybe what he said was, hi, mouse. Isn't this better than Zoom?
Yeah.
Something like that. Oh, and my then the God. Quick...
Exactly.
Just so that he gets that moment of horror in, and then...
Yeah. Oh, that's awful. You're...
Mm-hmm. It is awful.
Ouch. Yeah.
That seems very likely to me.
So the end of this chapter is actually the end of part 4. Do you guys have any other thoughts about the epigraph for this part? This one went fibers of the ventricles. These are arranged in an exceedingly complex manner, and the accounts given by various anatomists differ considerably.
I think that my thoughts are basically the same ones that I had at the beginning of this part. We get interviews with a bunch of different people. They all have a different idea of who Anami is. The case is getting more complex as they sort through all of these tangled fibers to find the truth, which is not helped by all the neo-Nazis and misogynists hanging around obscuring things on Twitter.
I agree. I also think it's a nice contrast with part 5.
All right, the epigraph for part 5. At the apex, the fibers turn suddenly inwards into the interior of the ventricle, forming what is called the vortex. And that is obviously from Grey's Anatomy by Henry Gray.
Yeah, so where the last one was talking about how everything is complex and you're getting different stories from different people, now we're starting to turn inwards and get to the heart of the thing, if you can excuse the pun. It works for the case because after this, it really kind of snowballs, and it also works for the personal now that he's ended things with Madeline, and after he was so close to realizing that he was in love with Robin the night before, things are turning more inward for Strike. Not just with Robin, but with his health and his leg.
Yeah, I completely agree with all that. Part 5 is leading up to, and it contains the climax of the novel. So all of these fibers turning inwards and coming together as a vortex, which ends in a single point, is very appropriate imagery for that.
Chapter 85.
In chapter 85, Strike and Robin speak to the police after finding Vikas's body.
And the epigraph, I thought my spirit and my heart were tamed to deadness, dead the pangs that agonize. And that's The Old House by Amy Levy. I think this is probably mostly about Robin's feelings about finding the body. I'm sure it's not fun for Strike, but we see her internal struggle about this more than his.
Mm-hmm.
This is Robin's third body now. Chisel, Margot, and now Vikas. Am I forgetting anyone?
She did get the leg.
Okay, 3 1/4. But I think the epigraph is saying that you might think you're used to it, but the horror is still shocking.
Yeah,
definitely. I think you're right about this interpretation. Robin says she's fine here, and it notes that it's not true. You know, she wants to get away from Cambridge, where this fresh horror has sort of imprinted itself in her mind. I think that this poem itself, it's about a woman confronting the ghost of her past self and her own past innocence, thinking that she's gone beyond feeling grief, but then feels it fresh again at the memory of who she used to be, which just sort of reminded me of Robin being sad, thinking about running down the beach towards the donkeys as a kid in troubled blood. You know, that sense of sadness for the person you used to be who hadn't seen 3 1/4 bodies.
Yeah.
She wouldn't choose to trade it, but she's still sad for who she was before a bit.
There really isn't a whole lot to this chapter. It opens up with Strike and Robin in this little room being somewhat aggressively questioned by a local officer who does not like them or the fact that they had skeleton keys. What do you guys think of this guy?
I can see why he's suspicious, but he pissed me off when he started getting annoyed by a Strike mentioning the happening, so he can go join the other assholes in the perpetual pointy Lego field.
I feel like there's no way that anybody in law enforcement wouldn't eventually know who they were.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe not at first, maybe they don't recognize them, but eventually when they give their names, they must know who they are. And this guy was just giving them a hard time. I feel like he's a future carver.
That seems likely. A ginger carver. Sounds like the name of a horrible serial killer who targets redheads.
Ginger carver.
The ginger carver.
I'm imagining Percy Weasley in like Order of the Phoenix.
Oh, yeah.
And then Angela Darwish shows up and walks them out after they explain Vikas had co-created the game. I always think about how irritating it must be for police, even the nice ones, that Strike and Robin are always one step ahead of them.
Really must be. And to me, it makes Murphy look like a really decent guy, because his reaction to Strike and Robin being a step ahead has generally been to be like amazed, impressed, grateful, seems like he genuinely cares about solving the crime and not so much about his own ego, like some other cops we could name in these books.
I think he's also trying to win Robin over a little bit.
Oh, true. Yeah. So he's being real nice about it.
Yeah, but I still have to imagine that there's a bit of, man, they got there ahead of me. You know, that's just human.
Yeah, yeah. There's got to be a little. So this moment when Darwish says that Vikas had been dead about 24 hours and Robin thinks that it had already been too late when they stopped for coffee. Do you think she's been beating herself up a bit for not making it in time? Like, if she'd somehow been just a bit faster, they could have saved him?
Yeah, of course. We talked last time about how this book is the book of what ifs. I think that Robin probably feels that more than anyone. Lots of counts.
Yeah.
So Strike and Robin talk about where they can stay. And can I just say that I love Strike's suggestion that they go stay at Nick and Elsa's, because that's definitely a place that only has one extra bed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sure that he would have insisted on sleeping on the couch, but still, you know, it would have come up. There would have been thoughts about, could we just share?
You know, Elsa would have suggested it. She'd have been like, oh, that couch, the springs, you guys should just share.
It's so uncomfortable.
Yeah. I'm renovating the couch. It's closed. There's only the bed.
Renovating the couch.
Can you imagine the look that Robin would give to Elsa, like, when Strike isn't looking?
It would have been amazing.
I want that scene.
And Elsa's just like, I'm doing this for you, dummy. Oh, I want to see that scene now. God damn it.
Me too. That'd be so funny. Okay, let's go to chapter 86.
In chapter 86, the agency has a team meeting.
The epigraph for this chapter reads, "A weary, impatient patience of my lot. Thus with myself, how fares it, friends, with you?" And that's from Later Life, a double sonnet of sonnets by Christina Rossetti.
I think this is just showing how they have an agency meeting and everyone tells what's going on with the cases that they're working on.
Yep, that's pretty much it. The line, weary, impatient patience, is a pretty accurate summary of both Robin and Strike at this point. They're fucking tired. They want this case to end, but they're working through it, you know?
So we see at the beginning of this chapter that Robin is feeling grief over Vikas being murdered. And it makes me happy that it seems like she actually tells Strike some of what she's feeling. She asks him if it's wrong to feel that it was particularly dreadful because he had been so brilliant.
Robin's feelings are hashtag relatable in this specific, because we too are filled with grief over Vikas, and it's even less justified for us than it is for her, because for us he's a fictional character and I'm still upset.
I can relate to Robin here breaking down and feeling so sad over the deaths of people she doesn't know, because I feel like the older I get, the more I feel that when something terrible happens.
Strike's line about how it's only eugenics if he personally starts shoving tossers in front of trains cracked me up though. I want to hear his list of tossers that he would start with if he ever did turn towards this.
Can Matthew be on that list?
I'd really like to see Robin's reaction
to that. I think she might laugh out loud.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? That just makes me think I really want a scene in the future where Matthew comes up and Strike finally says how he feels about it.
That fucking way.
Have you hated him this whole time? Of course I did.
Yes, he's that twat.
I'm very interested in Robin finding out how long... Well, both of them, but particularly Robin, finding out how long he has been attracted to her, you know, literally day one.
Yeah.
I really want to know her reaction to it.
God, me too.
Another thing I really liked was this part where Strike is talking about how it finally made sense to him why someone so brilliant would be in the game. Because even though Morehouse was a genius, he was only 16 when he started at Cambridge and really used this game for his social life. I just like that Strike recognized and pointed out the good side of the internet and totally understood why it must have been so important to Vikas.
Absolutely. It's add this to the list. All of these moments in this book where Strike and Robin, you know, instead of judging or laughing at these online people, for the most part, they seek to understand and empathize with these people with whom they could not be more different. This is not Strike and Robin's scene, but they're taking it seriously and they're trying to understand what it is for these people rather than just dismissing it.
How do you think they'd think about us doing a podcast?
My God,
them?
They would think we were nutters.
I know.
Are you kidding me? They'd be like, what the fuck?
Okay. And we're the ones that are attracted to Strike, so we're like extra nutty.
We're extra badly wired, I think.
I'm a fire risk. My wiring is going to spark a fire any moment. Yeah.
It made me laugh when Strike and Robin are trying to go through all the suspects and figure out who Morehouse would be likely to be best friends with, and Strike takes the opportunity to say, "And from what I heard on your recording, Pierce can be charming when he wants to be." Mm-hmm. I'm glad Robin didn't get mad this time.
It's such a shame that they'd ruled Gus out based on Yasmin's logins, though, because I feel like he would have shot up the suspect list as being the most similar to Vikas in terms of their situation, like the young male isolated prodigy.
Yeah. That's a really good observation on how and why Vikas and Gus became friends in the first place.
Yep, they were really similar.
We learned that Robin got to go home and pack a bag for the hotel, and it says that she was tempted to take the plants with her. Are we all wishing she had just to see Strike's reaction? That would have been so good.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine how touched he would be?
I can imagine. And I really wish she'd had, because he would have seen it in the next chapter when they're in her room together. And maybe it would have been the thing that kept him there instead of him leaving abruptly. And then who knows what could have happened.
I wonder why she chose not to take it. The only thing I can think is that maybe taking it was accepting that she'd have to be away from home for long enough to need to take it.
That makes sense to me.
I really hope we get to hear about the plants.
Oh my god, I guarantee that that's coming up in the Running Grave.
So Strike and Robin have different opinions on the hotel. She feels like it's cramped and soulless, where Strike is perfectly happy. I think it must be because Robin resents having to be there, and she feels stuck since she has to stay in and watch episodes of the Ink Black Heart all day.
Yeah, I can imagine that would make anyone feel a bit miserable.
But I think it's also clear that Robin enjoys having a comfortable space that sort of expresses her personality.
Mm-hmm.
She's such a Libra. Oh my Whereas Strike has always been shown to be much more concerned with the practical and doesn't really care about decorating or personalizing his space, unless it's to show off Jack's history papers, of course.
I'm going
to
ignore the Libra thing and just say that,
like that
it makes sense for how Strike grew up too, and contrasted with Robin, who probably is used to more of that home comfort.
Yeah.
I like the sort of implication that Strike liked her place because...
I do know because it's an expression of herself.
Well, no, but I mean, it's going to be his place at some, maybe not that place, but their shared space, you know.
Yes, her decorating taste. Yes,
he's fine with it.
Such a Sagittarius.
Oh my
Kidding,
god!
I don't know whether that's a Sagittarian thing or not.
Literally, none of it means anything. So
no, it's but fine. It's funny.
You could say that about anything, and someone would be like, "I know,"
and it's hilarious.
It's ridiculous. I think is the word. I think that's the word you were looking for. Ridiculous.
Yeah, it entertains me.
Okay, Midge and Barkley are the first to arrive for the team meeting, and Midge somewhat cryptically says that all went as planned that morning. Mm-hmm. We learned that she went and spoke with Jago Ross's first wife about the abuse her daughters were experiencing, and that she agreed to go for full custody. Oh. I was so relieved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So happy about this. I hope that Robin felt happy too.
I'm sure she did.
Do you think that because Robin has used this so often in this book to try and stay mad at Strike, then now that this is going away and he's done the right thing, the thing she was worried he wouldn't do, that it's going to be even harder to try not to love him?
Oh, for sure.
I want it.
She's going to be scraping the bottom of the barrel for things to be annoyed with him about.
I hope
Madeline's gone. This thing's gone.
Oh, I love it.
He's even stopped smoking. He's counting his calories. What the hell is she going to be mad at him about?
I don't know.
Hopeless. Poor
girl. It would kind of be nice if it was nothing and she's just failing miserably at not loving him. Oh,
she is going to be.
This is
going to
be another episode where I'm like thinking back, you were so wrong. We'll see. Do we know how many days it's been since the previous chapter where they found Morehouse? Just because the day that they found Morehouse was the day that Midge got the evidence on Jago, and where Strike says that he was going to try and help the girls. It just seems like Strike has put this plan into action fairly quickly and got Midge helping, all while dealing with everything else.
It says that Robin asked him about that whole grief for Morehouse thing 2 days later while they're in this cafe waiting. So it's been about 2 days.
Yeah, that's pretty quick, right?
Yeah.
I'm glad he took the time to get this all worked out. I'm sure he wants to put this behind him.
Yeah, he just wants this done and over with.
So Dev and Pat arrive, and my god, I think it's so cute when Strike tries to stand up to give Pat his chair.
So cute.
Oh my god, it is super cute. And Pat's response, "I can manage a stool, I'm not decrepit yet," is so funny.
I love it. That's her way of saying thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's also really great that Strike gives a little speech thanking all of them.
Yeah.
Because he's understanding the importance of building team morale now. He's doing some of that touchy-feely stuff with the employees.
I think we have seen quite a bit of that in this book with him.
He's learning. He's growing. But this line from Robin cracks me up. There isn't any KGB anymore. Also, what the hell? It just feels a bit striking. You start with the pedantic and then you move on to the profanities. Yeah. Like he's rubbing off on her.
I think the absolute best part about the fingers update is Strike wanting Dev, who he calls good looking, to go hit on Fingers' mother, and Barclay is wondering why he's not given the job.
I am so offended on Barclay's behalf. Outrageous.
Well, we know he looks like an owl, right?
An owl, maybe.
An affable owl.
Yeah.
Still.
But it's nice that they've got a pretty man on the payroll now, because it really widens the pool of people that they can use flirtation as a tactic with.
Yeah.
And he'll actually be a professional about it. I'm like, fucking Morris.
Yeah. Remember when you asked if there were any good-looking men who weren't jerks? We forgot about Dev. He's a good guy.
Dev's a good guy. Mm-hmm. He's a good, good-looking guy.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall when he tells his wife, Strike wants me to go flirt with this woman.
I bet that she was thrilled.
So the conversation turns to Annamie, and I just realized that part of the reason Robin must feel so bad later this evening when she gets banned is because Strike tells everyone that she's close to getting in the mod chat, and he thinks that it'll be key to breaking the case.
Oh, you are so right.
I feel so bad for her. Yeah.
I can't decide if I think that he genuinely thinks that or if he's really trying to boost the morale, because everyone was not happy to bring up Annamie.
Happy about this Annamie.
So if he's like, we're really close, you know, if he meant it or what. But either way, I think this does not help Robin's feelings when it's all taken from her.
Well,
later.
Considering he actually is really upset that she got banned and he's like, we didn't need this, I think he does kind of believe this a little. Maybe just hyping it up a bit.
Both. I think both is probably true.
Both, both is good.
And then Strike says that the Rosses will also be off the books tonight, and Robin asks if he's going to see him. I definitely remember being very excited.
Yeah, we're like, ooh, showdown.
I know. I didn't expect Charlotte to be there, but thank God that she is. Right?
Yes, it's fantastic. Oh my God. I'm so excited for this chapter.
Let's get right into it. Chapter 87.
Yes. In chapter 87, Strike visits the Ross's estate and breaks his connection with Charlotte for good.
So okay, who's lucky enough to get to do this epigraph? I think it's you, Kenz.
Oh boy. Oh man, that's awesome. Okay.
It's a good one.
It is. It is. This is another really good one. Great loves to the last have pulses red. All great loves that have ever died dropped dead. And that is Dropped Dead by Helen Hunt Jackson.
Oh, it's such a good epigraph. If there is anyone out there who doesn't believe that Strike is totally over Charlotte, please let me point your attention to this epigraph where it talks about love dropping dead.
Yep, this is so evocative of the moment, that single second where whatever love Strike still felt for Charlotte is wiped out. Mm-hmm. It's completely over for him. And this chapter, this moment is when that fatal blow is dealt. It's fantastic.
It really is. This has to be one of the most exciting ones in the whole book for me.
Yeah, same.
So this chapter is so juicy. So amazing. Good. It starts with Strike showing up at Jago's very fancy building. And I can't help but notice that Strike doesn't seem nervous at all. If this were me, I'd be nervous.
It's all that BDE.
It is. Yeah.
He knows he's powerful. Got this.
Can I just say that I love and I am laughing at Strike's thoughts about tipping for things that he can do perfectly well himself? Because totally agree. This is why being expected to tip stuff like bathroom attendance, which is ridiculous, annoys me. It's like, I can go to the bathroom by myself. Thanks.
That is the most awkward thing on the planet to
me. Oh, it so is. Oh my God.
I don't think I've ever been to a place fancy enough to have a bathroom attendant.
Yeah.
But
I think it was a wedding.
I would literally find somewhere else to pee because I don't need someone right there.
No, it's awful. Oh my God.
Can we pretend that we're inside Jago's head for a minute? Because we know that Charlotte's inside. And I wonder if part of wanting Strike to come upstairs is to try and confront her on this too. Like, what does he think is about to go down?
I was confused at first about why Jago doesn't seem at all surprised that Strike was here. I have only just now realized that it's because the porter called up to tell him But yeah, I'm guessing he assumes that Strike is there to like fight a duel over Charlotte or something. That seems like something they might do.
Yeah, break out the swords.
Yeah, yeah, pistols right. at dawn, sir. I slap my glove at your face.
Now you're just thinking of ghosts.
I am a little bit, yeah.
I bet you're right. And I bet that that makes the shock of why he's actually there so much better.
I know.
He's messed with the wrong dude.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't fuck with Strike.
Yep.
Jago fucked around.
And he found out.
He's about to find out right now. Yeah.
So were either of you surprised when Charlotte walked into the room? Because I definitely was. I was like, oh no, oh no.
Oh no.
When she sees him, there's this line that I think is really good. But Charlotte was looking at Strike, who saw with profound misgivings that she'd flushed with what looked like pleasure and hope. And I was like, girl, please.
Yeah, seriously. Like, get real, Charlotte.
I love this because she's about to get a reality check about Strike's feelings for her now. And I'm so excited for it.
I know. Me too. So good.
Yeah.
We have been waiting for this moment for 6 books.
For all my life. Oh, Lord.
We learned the reason that Charlotte is there is because Jago wants to pay her for full custody. And Charlotte says that he's offering $145,000 for the boy and $5,000 for the girl. And it seems like Charlotte's upset about this. What do you both think? Do you think that she's upset that the daughter isn't valued as much, or do you think that she doesn't care?
I find it very hard to believe that Charlotte gives two shits about these kids. Honestly, I'm inclined to think that she's putting on a bit of a performance about being concerned about the kids to appeal to Strike and get him on her side against Jago. You know, you see how she's just said, oh, you see how he treats me? Liar, liar, pants on fire. You know, I don't think that we have any reason to believe that her concern or disbelief or offense or anything is really all that genuine.
I don't think she really cares either. But accusing Ross of sexist favoritism is a pretty easy and a pretty accurate attack. So I think she's happy to use it, you know, whatever weapon you can.
Reading this fight that starts between Charlotte and Jago is like watching a car accident happen. It's so cringy, but you can't look away.
Oh, the cringe is intense. The moment where she randomly grabs some trinket and throws it at a mirror reminds me so much of Jan in the dinner party episode of The Office with Dundee and the fact that she doesn't even hit the mirror and she has to try again. Oh my god.
Yeah. And Jago's response is the same as Michael's. They both say that was an X amount of money item.
That was a $200 plasma screen TV.
That's kind of exactly how this feels though, because they're doing this in front of someone else. It's so awkward.
Thinking of Charlotte as Jan.
Oh no.
It's suddenly incredibly entertaining to me.
Yeah, I like that. They're both a bit unhinged. Like
they're both completely unhinged, yeah.
I was nice when I said a bit, that yeah, completely more accurate.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And when Jago brings up this man who he believes Charlotte is having an affair with, she denies it. I don't believe her. Do you?
Not in a million years. She's definitely sleeping with this guy.
She's most definitely sleeping with Landon, whoever he is.
Yeah. But the funniest thing is when she says, I did nothing with Landon and you know it. You're just trying to shit stir between Corm and me. It makes me laugh because Corm and me?
Yeah, nope.
I'm so glad that Strike immediately says that's a big no.
Right. He's immediately like, whoa. Yeah. Hold the fuck up.
But also, like, she hasn't been doing exactly that with Madeline and with Robin for this entire book.
Right.
She's the queen of devils and the queen of the stir.
The stirrer of shits.
Yeah. It's just funny how she's just so, oh, I can't. It is. You know, she's clutching her pearls at that.
How dare you shit stir? Okay, lady. He learned from the master, I presume.
So Strike drops the bomb that he has evidence of Jago abusing his daughters and that they've shown his ex-wife the footage and she's going to use it to get custody. He tells Charlotte that he's also mailed a copy to her house. And this kind of is really sad to me because do you think that he's doing this because he thinks that she'll also want to get evidence to get custody?
Absolutely. He wanted to make sure that these two babies didn't grow up with the same abuse. He figured that Charlotte wouldn't want them to.
Has anyone ever just said that Strike was and is way too good for Charlotte? Because he is literally too good for her.
Yeah. If I hadn't said it before, I'll say it now for sure. He is out of her league by a lot.
Oh, I really like him.
We know.
And we do too.
Yeah.
Anyway, let me come out of my...
Your reverie.
I don't know. Yeah. He lays it all out that if either of them mention his name, he'll mail a copy of the video to the media, which would be a bigger story than him possibly having an affair with Charlotte, which he's absolutely right. And I just want to take a moment to appreciate Strike's parting words. So he says... Don't forget, I've got the nanny's name and address and the notes of her conversation, and I've got those videos. One call to a news desk and we'll see whose name gets dragged through the mud. So you both think long and hard about involving me in any of your shit ever again. Ooh. And then he drops the mic and walks out.
Damn.
Ugh. Beautiful. This whole parting monologue is just perfection.
I wonder if he practiced it or at least thought of what he was going to say, or if that just comes out.
He had like a fake argument in the shower with them. Yeah. I mean,
how could you not? Right.
Yeah.
But when he leaves, I remember reading this and thinking, run, Cormoran, run, because you know that Charlotte is right behind him.
Too bad he's not really capable.
I know. But I just wanted him to get away as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Did either of you think for even just a second that Shrike was going to give in to Charlotte here?
No way.
No, absolutely not. I had no fear of that. I think we've seen the power of her over him fading for a few books now. And he knows that giving into her would be a monumentally idiotic idea. Yeah. Only the sort of crazy powerful longing of those first couple books might be enough to counteract that knowledge.
I don't think I ever actually thought he was going to, but this moment was one part of the book where I think I was the most anxious. I couldn't even take the words in fully until I got to the end, and then I had to go back and reread them because the whole time I was just like, oh my god, oh my god, yeah. Oh my god. Yeah, I was really anxious.
Don't worry. Not even Strike is going to fuck up that bad. There's a floor.
Yeah,
and it would
I know.
Be way beneath that.
It's clear, though, that she's after him, right? The flushed face. She's touching his arm.
She's not subtle.
Yeah, she wants him pretty bad. I mean.
Mm-hmm. Can you blame her? So this line where Strike says, I don't lie. He lied. We know he lies. He lied to Madeline just a few chapters ago, but he's not lying here. I don't think. He really doesn't want her. He really did not do this for her.
This is the first time she's even learning that he did it. And he had no idea that she'd be there.
Exactly.
Please, she said softly, and he knew she still believed the old power she'd exerted over him for so long lingered, that beneath his anger and impatience lay the love that had survived so many ugly scenes. Please, one drink. Corm, I told you when I was dying. When I was dying, it could have been my last words. I love you.
You know what I love about this? She thinks she's tempting him, but who is he actually tempted by in just about a half an hour?
Oh, I love that so much. That's really good.
Yeah. Me too. Uh-huh. It's also a horrible manipulation that she is still using her suicide attempt to try and get him. This woman has not changed in the entire 21 years that he's known her.
Yeah. Her shtick is getting old.
Strike's response is so good because he says that even if he wasn't done with her, which, whew, that's good, he would never want to help raise Jago Ross's kids. And then here's where it happens.
And it is so, so good.
I know.
Yes.
Well, it'll be joint custody now, I expect. They won't be with me all the time. With those words, the busy night seemed to slow again around Cormoran Strike, and the constant growl of traffic seemed suddenly muted. This time, he wasn't staring down into Robin's face full of alcohol and desire. The seismic change had happened inside him because he felt something break, and he knew, at last, that there was no putting it back together.
Oh, so good. I love that he's reminded of Robin here.
Yes, the parallel with time slowing both times. Mm-hmm. These are monumental moments. These are Kairos moments, if you will, marking here the complete break with his past relationship and earlier a willingness to embark on this new one with the woman he really wants. It's really beautiful.
The next two paragraphs are so good. Probably too long to read it all, but he's thinking about how he'd always believed that they'd shared a similar core and that he'd cleaved romantically to the idea that her childhood, like his, had left her with a desire to refashion her corner of the world into a saner, safer, kinder place. First of all, the fact that this means that making the world a saner, safer, kinder place is his desire, it kills me. That's very sweet.
Oh, yes, it is. And you know what woman does share a similar core to him?
Okay.
Who does want to turn her corner of the world into a safer, saner, and kinder place? I'm going to need to visit the emotions closet now.
Yeah, I'm going to join you there.
Do you remember when he thinks about one of the reasons why it can't work with Robin is because they come from two different, their upbringing was too different?
Oh my God, yes.
That has to be because of this thing that he thought that he had. where they're the same person, but he and Robin do share that core, even though they had such different childhoods.
That doesn't even matter.
He was focusing on superficial similarities and was assuming that they meant a deeper sameness, but they didn't. He's wrong. He's focusing on
the wrong thing.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's really good.
Can I join you in the emotions closet?
Yes. I'm already in there. We've got plenty of room.
Yeah. But this is when it also says, and now he saw that he'd been entirely wrong. Whatever else he might have thought of Charlotte, never once had he doubted that she'd now do what Ross's ex-wife was preparing to do, to fight to keep the children safe from their father. It kind of hurts me because I can relate to the shock of realizing someone isn't going to fight to protect their kids. And it must be painful for him to realize that she's not who he thought she was.
Yeah, but also freeing in a way.
Oh, yeah. I'm not that sad about it.
Yeah, no one's really that sad.
Let me be clear. It's not that I'm sad for this relationship. I just know how that feels to be like, I cannot believe you're not going to protect your kids. I also really like that Charlotte asks why he's looking at her like that. And I wonder what his face must have looked like, because I'm guessing it's just total disgust.
Yeah, disgust, disbelief.
I'm thinking he must have looked just completely disgusted. And I really, really hope that this scene makes it into the adaptation, because just think about Tom Burke and Natasha O'Keefe in this scene. They would knock it out of the fucking park.
So would, yes.
It's going to be so good. I'm really excited to start getting information on this adaptation, because there's a lot of things that I really am looking forward to.
Me too. You know, as much as I want Charlotte to just, you know, fuck off forever.
Can that be the title of this episode?
Fuck off forever. A big part of me wants her to show up again just to delight in her increasing futile desperation to get Strike back. And also to see her through Strike's eyes once that love has been completely stripped away. Mm-hmm. I think he'll see her a lot more clearly. And I really want to witness what he's going to think when he's interacting with her in the future.
I totally agree with you. You know, I see a lot of opinions online that say they want Charlotte to stay around because they enjoy the drama or that she's entertaining. And I don't really share that opinion, because at some point that loses its oomph, you know, but that is exactly why I would want Charlotte to come back, because I've always wanted to see his thoughts after that spell was broken.
Yes.
I think it could happen too, because we get those early comparisons of Charlotte to Robin and how Robin couldn't hold a candle to Charlotte. And I really do think that we could see that come full circle at some point soon. Oh, I might have to put that on my predictions list.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Ooh, yeah.
Oh, I really want that.
I really do think that you're right. I think that we might get to see that. Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like this ending is somehow the opposite of the Ritz, where he's standing there and he gets a taxi for Robin, and now Charlotte is left standing there and he is the one escaping in the taxi.
Yeah, he sends her away after being rejected. And now he's rejecting her and being like, bye. Peace, I'm out.
And notice how she's one of the most beautiful women and not the most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. I noticed that. Oh my God. It's a very important distinction. You know, she's not the most beautiful woman in London to him anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure we'll talk about this next time. But the contrast between Charlotte all done up for seduction and Robin being, you know, barefaced in pajamas.
All of Charlotte's arts are no longer enough to snare him. But just Robin, who she is, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man.
Probably helps she's not wearing a bra too.
Yeah, that probably helps too. Yeah. Yeah. I think we have a lot to talk about with that. Yeah.
We need to spend like 5 minutes just on that.
Robin
just talking about Robin's boobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It must be done.
It is our solemn duty as Strike podcasters to cover the important topics that people want to hear about.
I was gonna say, Lindsay, that I got the same sort of reverse Ritz vibes from the scene that you do. And I think that maybe they're meant to mirror each other a little bit, because both of these are pivotal moments between Strike and these two women. You know, one ends up breaking them apart completely and the other ends up bringing them closer together.
I wonder how long J.K. Rowling has been planning on this chapter. This has to be one of the chapters that was exciting for her to write.
I bet it was, yeah. I want to know what other chapters coming up she's been planning forever.
Of course. What do you think is going on in Charlotte's head right now? Do you think she knows that she's lost?
I don't think that she knows that she's lost, honestly. Yeah. I think that she's totally delusional, and I have no doubt that she's going to try concocting some other evil scheme in the next book, maybe instead just going straight to Robin rather than just being like, oh yeah, yeah, you look like Corm's girlfriend. I think she's going to try and do some shit stirring.
Oh no.
Has Charlotte ever had a man reject her before? She must be so confused. But, you know, I have zero sympathy over here for her. Good luck with this whole mess, Landon.
Yeah, have fun. Seriously.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Landon.
Yeah. Ooh. I wonder if Charlotte had to go back upstairs for anything. Like, does she have a bag upstairs? Because I want to know if Jago can see it in her face that she's just been rejected by
Strike.
That would
have been so good.
I know. I also like seeing the buildup. You know, we've seen the seeds being planted about Charlotte and that he thinks of her like a drug that he's never going to get over. And we've seen it build and build and build. And now we're finally seeing the payoff of him really breaking that connection. It's so exciting because I know we have more of that in store for us.
Yes.
That's such an amazing chapter.
Oh,
it is.
All right. So what are we doing in our next episode, Kenz?
All right. So in the next episode, we're going to be covering chapters 88 through 92, and we're going to have a brand new guest that we have never had on the show before.
We are.
Kurt is going to be joining us, and he actually did a blog post for us not too long ago. So we'll have him on the show, and his handle is KASSTL1. On Twitter. But anyway, so on the next episode, there's a lot of cool stuff that happens. We see Robin getting banned from Drex game, which is really awesome to read. We have Strike and Robin visiting Scotland Yard at Murphy's request. And then we have Strike speaking with Yasmin.
Oh, that should be fun for you, Pauls.
Oh, I forgot that happened.
All in all, it's going to be a fun episode. Oh, and I forgot to mention Robin being braless, obviously, is in this episode. So,
right. That, how could you forget that? Exciting. Come on, talk about important things. Yeah, really. Oh, yeah. Well, that'll be fun.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at The SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.